Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's this about, Gary? What is it? What is it about?
Well, this one is about the evacuation of Suvla and Anzac of December 1915.
That's a tough call, evacuating there. Anzac, they're all right next to each other. They don't have far to go, but they're right next to each other, within yards, a matter of yards, a matter of feet. And at Suvla, they've got 3 or 4 miles to fall back. How are they going to do it? How, Gary?
Well, we tell about things like the conditioning of the Turks by not firing all the time, and then suddenly firing.
So quiet doesn't mean gone. It's a great story. I can't wait to hear that episode again.
Until they were gone, then quiet did mean they'd gone.
Oh yeah, it did. Yeah, they had gone.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, Gary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans about their experience of war. Join me on a journey through the pages of history. Welcome to Peter Hart's Military History.
Hello, and welcome to Peter Hart's Military History Podcast. And I'm joined, as ever, on Zoom with lovely Gary Bain, who's looking particularly gorgeous. And I believe you are accompanied somewhere in the room with the mysterious, silent but deadly presence of Fred the farting dog.
No, he's gone. He knew you were coming, so I've had to open the door, let him out. He's best in the fresh air, to be honest.
A dog that's yes. Well, let's get on with it. Let's get on with it early today. Less of this merry, cheerful banter. We're doing the evacuation of Suvla and Anzac in December 1915. Why are we doing that?
Why are we doing this, Peter?
Well, because Matt said we had to. Matt said you've got to publicise your book, The Evacuation of Gallipoli, which is coming out on Living History. And I said, what book? And he said that, you know, that thing you were typing, you know, and all the rest of it. And I, oh, that.
So what's it about?
Anyway, I've forgotten. It was nearly 2 weeks ago, Gary. You know, no, it's about the evacuation of Gallipoli. And this is the first of two podcasts that will be dealing with the subject. This one is on the evacuation of Anzac, Suvla. And the second podcast, which will be out in a few weeks, is on the evacuation of Helles. So should we kick off, Gary?
Who's Shuey? I was in the army with a bloke called Shuey, actually.
Yeah, we don't want to know that story.
Yeah, let's go.
And I've never believed that was animatically possible. Anyway. Right, so, well, if you're looking at Anzac, you could, well, Helles, Anzac, Gallipoli, you could see it as a sort of tragedy in six acts. You know, it's classical, just near Troy, so let's be classical, eh? You're very classical. You had a classical education. The conception, the abortive naval operations, you've got the landings on the 25th of April, you've got the furious battles at Helles, which everyone forgets about, Australian. Then we've got the Anzac breakout, the new Suvla, accompanied by the new Suvla landings, and then finally the evacuation. But do you know what? People always treat it as if it's inevitable, that they've got to evacuate, that there's no option. But that wasn't the case at the time. And Hamilton was definitely not Hamilton, Sir Ian Hamilton, the commander of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, or Eastern Expeditionary Force, rather. He just asked for more men. He always asked for more men. Can I have some more men, please, sir? And Lord Kitchener, he wanted 95,000 more men. But
Where were 95,000 men meant to come from, Peter?
Well, that's the point, isn't it, Gary? Because the Battle of Loos is going to start on the 25th of September, 1915. It's difficult to send guns because it's also the time of the shell shortage. It's just bloody madness.
And what about the French? What were the French doing at this time?
Well, they were being difficult, Gary.
Not like the French.
No, not at all. They were being very variable. Some of the politicians still believed that Gallipoli would be a golden vision of the future, that it would work, they'd get Constantinople, they'd get Syria, that's what they really wanted. Didn't want to give up on it. Joffre, on the other hand, was dead against it. He was the commander-in-chief of the French army on the Western Front. Some of them wanted to get rid of a difficult general called Sarail and pack him off to command a force in Gallipoli. There was all sorts of motivations, but the French basically couldn't make their mind up what to do. There was one bunch of people who were quite decisive. Can you think who that might be? A group of people. I can hear Fred. Yeah. A group of people. Can I come in? I feel smelly. Who do you think, talking of smelly, and that's not fair, who do you think were decisive? Who did know what they wanted to do, do you think?
Usually it's the Germans.
The Germans, yeah. Germans. And they knew exactly what they wanted to do. Their chief of general staff, Falkenhayn, decided that if the Turks were going to stay in the war, he had to open up a direct rail route to Turkey so that they could send stores, all the rest of it. But there's something in the way, and that's Serbia. So what the Germans did was negotiate with Bulgaria, get them to join the Central Powers with the aim of knocking Serbia out of the war. That was what they intended to do. That was, you know, and then they could send anything, ammunition, heavy guns to the Turks. They could do what they liked, really. And this worked, and eventually, 1st of October, Bulgaria declares war. So there's another Central Power then. And at that moment, in truth, Gallipoli becomes a real backwater. Because the French, really, they want to support Serbia. The British don't know what they're doing. The French go mad. The French rush into action and start talking about sending reinforcements. And in a way, Gary, it's exactly like at the start of Gallipoli. Nobody thinks about Salonika properly. No one talks it through. There's no proper planning. But they want to send as many divisions as possible. And two British divisions, one French, are going to have to come from Gallipoli.
And they're going to go to Salonika.
Yeah. And this is, which, you know, is a Greek port which has access to where they're going to be fighting on what was known as the Salonika, the Doiran area, that. Now, this meant we were now going to fight on three fronts. Now, we couldn't manage to fight on two fronts, but we're going to fight on three fronts. And people start to go, you know, do you think we can get out of Gallipoli? And Lord Kitchener says, he's the Secretary of State for War, he says this: what is your estimate of the probable losses which would be entailed to your force if the evacuation of the Gallipoli Peninsula was decided on and carried out in the most careful manner? No decision has been arrived yet on this question of evacuation, but I feel that you ought to have your views. In your reply, you need not consider the possible future danger to the Empire that might thus caused. So this is a shot across Hamilton's bows. Now, how do you think Hamilton reacts? I mean, you've got a quote there from Hamilton, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, Hamilton was apoplectic with rage and a very, very frustrated man. And he said, "If they do this, they make the Dardanelles into the bloodiest tragedy of the world. Even if we were to escape without a scratch, they would stamp our enterprise as the bloodiest of all tragedies. Kay has always sworn by all his gods he would have no hand in it. I won't touch it." And I think he knew that and calculated on that when he cabled.
Huh. Well, that's not quite what was going on. Hamilton was already in trouble about his handling of the Gallipoli campaign. We don't need to go into that. But when on 14th of October the Dardanelles Committee, which is like the War Cabinet, they met to reconsider it. And they decided to recall Hamilton. And their replacement choice was, in my view, an excellent choice. He was General Sir Charles Monroe, who was commanding the Third Army on the Western Front. He's a proper Westerner, and he's a good, thoughtful, modern general. While they're waiting for him to come out, Hamilton's staff officers start to, you know, look at the options for their new commander-in-chief, because, you know, that's what staff officers do. And Gary, sorry.
I was going to say, was there no plan prior to this for evacuation at all?
There doesn't seem to have been. I mean, the last time it was mentioned properly was on the night of the landing, when they thought of evacuating.
What, 25th of April? As far back as the 25th of April?
But since then, it had just seemed impossible. And when you read the options... I love the options the staff say. Option one, could we have 10 French divisions, please, to create an attacking army of 250,000 men? Oh, and we also, in our total, because we have to replenish our depleted ranks, and we've got to fight the Turks all winter, because we won't be able to attack until the spring of 1960, can we have 400,000 reinforcements in total? You know, where are they coming from, Gary? Where? And they reckon a voluntary evacuation, they think it was possible, but they'd lose 50% of the men and 66% of the guns.
And what did they think the Turks would be doing during all this time if they had 250,000 men and waiting for the spring to come along before they could do anything?
I don't know. It's madness. The Turks would be moving up their own 250 or 400,000 men. Whatever we could do, it was easier for them to do because they're not the other end of the world. Now, Monroe, when he gets out there, he makes... it's famous. Churchill always says, he came, he saw, he capitulated. On the 30th of October, he visited Helles, Anzac and Suvla in a single day, which you'd be hard pushed to do now.
Yeah.
But... Kitchener was poke, poke, pokey. I want to know. I want poke, poke, pokey, you know. He met with his corps commanders. We better introduce them. Lieutenant General Sir William Birdwood, British, commander of the Anzac Corps. Lieutenant General Sir Julian Byng, 9th Corps, out-and-out Westerner, sent out there because everybody else was so useless. They'd sent out in August. He was commanding 9th Corps. And Lieutenant General Sir Francis Davis, often known as Joey, he was commanding 8th Corps. That's the Helles Mott. 9th Corps were at Suvla. Sorry, I should have said that. And he also talked to some of the divisional questions. He asked two questions. Could they launch a sustained offensive? And could they hold back a serious Turkish attack? And the consensus was, and there's variations, that they could only manage a short 24-hour offensive and that they might be able to hold the Turks, but if they got unlimited ammunition via Serbia, you know, via Bulgaria, they couldn't. Can you imagine a professional soldier like Monroe? And particularly, I always like to picture him arriving at Anzac. Is that a beachhead? In any way, do you think that's a proper beachhead? And think about D-Day when it's bloody miles inland. It's quarter of a mile, half a mile inland. It's bloody ridiculous, isn't it? And he looked at it. He must have looked at the piers. He must have looked at the open beach. He must have looked at the stupid logistic arrangements. And he looked at the fact that it was coming winter. And he looked at the fact it was all under shell fire. In fact, most of it's under bloody small arms fire. And... whatever he thought when he left London, he was bloody certain after he'd seen it. And you've been. It's not a realistic... Anzac is not realistic as a military option.
No, but nothing had changed. I mean, it had been that case throughout. And so, you know, there must have been some critical eyes, for want of a better word, in Hamilton's staff looking at that. I mean, it didn't change. It was the same.
Well, there seemed to have been almost a cult. His staff officers were absolutely as bound up with it as him. And it, one of his staff officers wrote the official history, Aspinall Oglander. He hid his name a bit. He was Colonel Aspinall then. And he took something, I think it was a rich woman, so he took her surname. He wrote the official history, and even the official history never stops, you know, saying, oh, what a great idea. Anyway, this is what Sir Charles Monroe said. The positions occupied by our troops presented a military situation unique in history. The mere fringe of the coastline had been secured. The beaches and piers upon which they depended for all requirements in personnel and material were exposed to registered and observed artillery fire. Our entrenchments were dominated almost throughout by the Turks. The possible artillery positions were insufficient and defective. The force, in short, held a line possessing every possible military defect. The position was without depth. The communications were insecure and dependent on the weather. No means existed for the concealment and deployment of fresh troops destined for the offensive. Whilst the Turks enjoyed full powers of observation, abundant artillery positions, and they had been given the time to supplement the natural advantages which the position presented by all the devices at the disposal of the field engineer. Now, to me, this is an unanswerable argument. And I believe now that 99.9% of historians of whatever sort, you know, would agree. You know, all right, I'm you know. And on the 31st of October, he telegraphs his report back to Kitchener. And he says straight to the point, evacuation. That's the answer. That's what you've got to do.
I think it's worth emphasising the date here. 31st of October.
Yeah.
That's his recommendation.
Yeah. You know, he gets there, he came, he saw, he didn't capitulate, he made a logical assessment and passed it on. Kitchener had wanted an immediate response, but of course when he got it, yeah, you know, it's almost like a politician, although he is a real army bloke, but he sort of, having got the immediate response, he wasn't happy. His preoccupation throughout is that if you're beaten by a Muslim power, i.e. the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, this will do damage to your Muslim empire. Which is India.
Yeah. I was going to say, he's presumably very concerned with India.
So he immediately, instead of taking immediate action or pressing it on the cabinet, goes into his own thought processes and starts delaying. But to give him credit, he does tell Monroe to begin the planning, you know, the planning process. And it's an enormous planning task. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's joint service, so they have to have a joint service committee. So Monroe gets Birdwood and de Roebuck. Now Birdwood, Anzac Corps, and de Roebuck commanding the Navy and the Eastern Squadron, they establish a committee to sort of hammer through the details. This is way before it's been approved, you know. Back in London, everybody's going, what the? I can't imagine what they were saying. And Kitchener, and they sort of say, no. So Kitchener, you've got to go. Britain's greatest soldier, also Secretary of State for War. You've got to go out yourself because Monroe might be talking rubbish. Off he goes. And then there's just the maddest period that I've ever seen. I mean, I give up in the book trying to explain it. Monroe's sacked by Kitchener, reinstated. The Royal Navy go bonkers and start saying, oh, well, perhaps we can get through the Straits as long as there's a diversionary attack. Yeah, we can do it, which is just bollocks.
But that wasn't de Roebuck, was it? That wasn't de Roebuck.
That was his chief of staff, Keyes, and one of his senior officers, Weems, Roslyn Weems.
Because wasn't there a view that Weems would have to take over from de Roebuck?
He does later on because de Roebuck has to go back ill. Yeah, So the Royal Navy's been a real pain in the backside as far as the generals are concerned throughout this period. They suggest a landing in the Gulf of Saros, which is up by Belair, a landing at Alexandretta, you know, where that pisses the French off because it's in Syria. I mean, everything and everything suggested. It's just a barking mad period. Then Kitchener arrives and he does a 3-day series of visits. Helles, Anzac and Suvla, 12th to 14th of November. Already lost 2 weeks, Gary. 2 weeks
gone. Why didn't he do it in a day?
Well, because he's older.
Oh, I see.
Bit like yourself, Gary. He's not in the first flush of youth, you know.
So, on arrival, he embarks on a 3-day appreciation of the situation at Anzac Suva.
And there's a quote here from Birdwood, you know, which gives an idea of what this professional soldier thought.
Lieutenant General William Birdwood. After a glance round, he put his hand on my arm and said, "Thank God, Birdie. I came to see this for myself. You were quite right. I had no idea of the difficulties you were up against. I think you've all done wonders."
Because in the end, I think Kitchener is a professional soldier. He might be older. His day might have been 15 years earlier, but he's still got the basic skills.
And hadn't he worked with Birdwood before? He knew him, didn't he?
Yeah.
So he presumably trusted him.
Yeah, Birdwood had been his chief of staff, I think, in India. I mean, and also they'd known each other in the Boer War. And he could not deny the merit of what what Munro had said. He just couldn't. On 22nd of November, he telegraphs back to recommend the evacuation of Anzac and Suvla. Now, here's another cut. What's missing from that?
Helles. I mean, what a bonkers idea, in my opinion, I hasten to add.
The Royal Navy, they're worried about the shortage of small boats. Fair enough. But they also seem to think of it as some sort of miniature Gibraltar that's going to help them in the war against U-boats in the Mediterranean and the Aegean. I know last podcast I referred to that as the Adriatic. I'm an idiot. The Aegean and the Adriatic.
So it's worth noting at this point, this is now 1 month on from Munro's original recommendation.
Yeah, so what they do is, not quite a month, but what he does is when his recommendation gets back, they decide, oh, we've got to debate this. The war committee accept it, but say, no, we're going to give up Helles as well. But then when it goes to the cabinet, they go berserk because they are, oh my God. And they say, well, we'd better defer this to the 24th of November. This is when it started to be pushed.
And this is my point about, we're now getting into months later.
The
point I'm trying to emphasise here, Pete, is Munro make a really, in my view, correct decision very quickly. And now we're a month further on. And whilst they've started planning, probably, without any real direction from above, it's a month further on.
They had some direction wrong because Munro is set on it, and that's one thing that impresses Kitchener, how set Munro is, how he's not going to change his mind. And that does. Munro's appointed commander in chief of all Mediterranean forces outside Egypt, and Birdwood is appointed commander in chief of what's now going to be called the Dardanelles army. So left. Lieutenant General Sir Brian Mahon, whose name I can't pronounce, I'm told it's Mahon, but there you go. He's put in charge of the Salonika, and Birdwood is replaced by Lieutenant General Sir Alexander Godley, who we always think is a New Zealander, commander. He had commanded the New Zealand and Australian division. But then the British cabinet, they meet on the 24th of November, and do you know what? Soldiers often don't like politicians, but Jesus wept, this gives you good reason. Look who's for evacuation. Kitchener, Munro, most of the senior military officers at Gallipoli on military grounds. Birdwood's worried about, like Kitchener, worried about the Empire. You've got the General Staff of the War Office, the War Committee, but the great men, those great men, those great politicians in the war cabinet, they can't make their mind up. And most influential of all is a sort of bombastic figure of Lord Curzon, who was the Lord Privy Seal. So he's right up, really involved, in my view. And his argument is always quoted. And you can tell the guy's educated, but Jesus wept, what an idiot. How many people in politics today have who have a classical education but are complete and utter fuckwits? And this is one of them, Lord Curzon. The evacuation and the final scenes will be enacted at night. Our guns will continue firing till the last moment, but the trenches will have to be taken one by one, and a moment must come when a final sauve qui peut takes place, and when a disorganised crowd will press in despairing tumult onto the shore and into the boat. Shells will be falling, the bullets ploughing their way into this mass of retreating humanity. Conceive the crowding into the boats of thousands of half-crazy men, the swamping of craft, the nocturnal panic, the agony of the wounded, the hecatombs. What's a hecatomb when it's at home? Of the slain. And when you hear this, do you not think, what a wanker? They're ducking. I mean, all he's doing, he's been told by all the professionals that they can't stay, but he's worrying about what will happen if they try and get off. That's not his job.
I think that whilst, it's right, potentially it would have been terrible. It could have been terrible.
Yes.
But it was no worse than the loss of life that would have occurred from continuing futile attacks at both Anzac and Suvla.
And of course, being just shelled out. And what happens if the winter, if the port's destroyed? When I say port, I mean a couple of wharfs and a jetty or two, you know. Anyway, I think one old soldier, he's Major General Sir Charles Caldwell, Director of Military Operations. I think you should read this one because I think it just sums it up.
Major General Sir Charles Caldwell. He said, "We have four enemies to contend with. The Boche, the Turks, the Bulgars and His Majesty's government. And the last is the most deadly. It is deplorable that it should be so."
Now, how many modern soldiers, as they think back of the deployments they've made in various places, Iraq, Afghanistan, must be thinking, "Oh yeah, I know that feeling. Politicians are the most deadly enemies of all." But how are they going to do it? Now, back at the farm, Birdwood, his joint committee, Monroe, they're all pondering what to do. And Birdwood is the lead general officer. He's now commanding a Dardanelles officer. And his plans are he's got a plan to evacuate just Suvla and Anzac. Helles is going to have to wait. And the Joint Service Planning Committee swing into action. And on that, there was a chap called Brigadier General George McMunn. And he is a logistics expert. Now, expert's a terrible word these days. But actually, part of the success of the British Army in the Great War is the bringing in of experts, people who actually knew what they were talking about. And he explained the plan they came up, and they submit it to Birdwood at a conference on the 22nd of November. Now, I want you to note that's before the cabinet meeting, where Curzon gives his blathering. And he says, "We propose that the withdrawal should be in three stages. A, preliminary. B, intermediate. C, final." Now, you might say, "Pete, everything's three stages." When you were planning the destruction of transport for London, you know, you had three stages in mind, I'm sure. Preliminary, intermediate and final. But he goes on. "The preliminary stage was to be of an indefinite duration during which troops, animals and stores not required for a defensive winter campaign should go." Now, I should explain that then is while the politicians are making their mind up. "The intermediate stage would be that in which troops and guns not essential for the tactical withdrawal should go." We put this stage at 4 days. So what he's saying there is that 4 days in which they get off anything they could, but leave enough to defend against a Turkish attack in the last, you know, the final stage. "The final stage would be the actual tactical withdrawal of the essential unencumbered fighting troops, who might, if need be, abandon one third of their guns." Okay? So that is the sort of thing. And the preliminary stage would commence immediately. They've got no time to waste because they're worried about winter storms. We'll come back to that. Now, the tactical methodology, a big word that to me, isn't in their hat. That goes back to Birdwood. And Birdwood gives it to Godley's and his old chief of staff, Brigadier General Brudenell White. Now, mark well his name, Gary, because this man, if there's a hero of the evacuation, this is him. He is in charge of the detailed planning of how they're actually going to do these stages. And he thought it through, and he was a great officer. He decided the only chance was to deceive the Turks to the last minute, to leave them in total ignorance until it was too late. Now, you've got to look at the problems he's facing. At Suvla, there's a 3 mile from the front line, overlooked front line, quite a distance between the lines, 200, 300 yards often, but, three or four miles to get back to the beaches. So that's one set of tactical problems. At Anzac, 2 or 3 yards between them, but only about half a mile to get back. So there's different problems. But whatever, he decides a consistent approach that the final stages should be hidden from the Turks. Everything should be done. Every trick should be employed to try and keep the Turks in total ignorance. But his biggest thing was the periods of silence. And I love this because what he decided was that he'd start this right of way. And on the night the British cabinet is engaging in a what could be called as mutual masturbation session back in London, he institutes periods of silence. What's clever about that?
Well, it's brilliant because, I mean, it's really simple. what he wants to do is to try and train the Turks to expect a period of silences, and that doesn't mean that there's nobody there. So if they pop up and have a walk around, presumably on occasions they wouldn't be shot at, and on other occasions they would be shot at, so that they wouldn't quite know whether or not they should take any notice of the silence at all.
So it's like a Pavlov's Fred the dog.
If only I knew who Pavlov was. I thought that was like an ice cream and dessert type thing.
But it is brilliant, the idea, you know, and you could just, you know, you can imagine the Turks, you know, it all goes quiet. They sort of poke their head cautiously above, nothing happens. They have a look, nothing happens. They sit on the parapet, nothing happens. They go into no man's land, nothing happens. And, you know, two or three days later, all hell breaks loose. And, you know, they must have thought, what the bloody hell's going on? And confusion. They'd get a bloody nose, and that would make, what would that make the man in the front trench?
Well, you'd be very careful, wouldn't you? Because you'd never know.
You wouldn't know. And they thought it might be just part of the new, perhaps they're a bit short of ammunition, whatever. You can imagine the Turks thinking, well, I don't know what they're up to. I've no idea what they're up to. But it's just the new, it becomes a new routine. It becomes something that they live with, that they're, you know, they're used to. And you know, meanwhile, they're all building up the logistical things, you know, the piers and everything else. But you see, Canongeiser, they could see they're working on the piers and things, but this is what he thought. And this, go on, tell me, who is Canongeiser, seeing as you don't like me introducing
Well,
you?
Colonel Hans Canongeiser, he's an attached German officer, in command of the Turkish 18th Corps. And he was fooled. He said, rumours and suggestions that the enemy were going to evacuate Gallipoli naturally swarmed around us on Gallipoli. I personally did not believe in such a possibility because, taking into account the English character, I considered it out of the question that they would give up such a hostage of their own free will and without a fight.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
So, you know, this is something that's going on. There's a phrase that I know you're an aficionado of popular culture. You've probably heard it. Winter is coming.
No, I never heard of it.
That's because you've never watched Game of Thrones, isn't
no,
it?
No, never watched it.
It's great. It's great. Anyway, winter's coming, and winter is coming. I mean, Gallipoli's lovely. Isn't it lovely? It's lovely. It's always sunny and warm. And
in fact, it's
lovely.
Too warm sometimes. It's so warm.
Lovely and warm. But round about the back end of October, moving into this November, particularly late November, things start to change. And on the 26th of Friday, 26th of November, it starts to pour down. Now, I did a podcast on the Great Storm, but so I'll just sketch it out. You can listen to that on Living History. But there's a tremendous storm. The rain teems down like there's no tomorrow, like a bloody monsoon. And then 1 o'clock next day, Saturday, a real tragedy. The rain stops and it freezes. And then it starts to snow. And it is just the perfect storm, Gary. And can you imagine just being sat there, you know, in a flooded trench that's freezing for hour after hour? Not for a couple of hours or even 5 or 6 hours, for 3 days. I mean...
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out, Peter, isn't it, that you know, people think of Turkey as a holiday destination and sometimes, you know, go all year round. This is coming from the Russian steppes, isn't it? And we're not talking just cold. We are talking Russian cold. Those really freezing temperatures. Insufferable temperatures, I would suggest.
20 below zero, some of them say. I'm not sure that's Fahrenheit. That was going to be Fahrenheit, I'm certain. But, you know, it's just ridiculous. There's a quote from a Colonel Bendel of the 2nd 3rd Londons, and it's sentimental, but it gives you the idea. Two brothers of C Company had died together. The arm of one was round the other's neck. The fingers held a piece of biscuit to the frozen mouth. It seemed a strange and inexplicable thing that these men who had come to fight and had fought bravely had been killed by the elements. And Gary, this is serious. 200 die of hypothermia, frozen to death essentially, and 5,000 had to be evacuated with frostbite, hypothermia, and basically near death. This is a terrible time. And can you imagine, do you think the politicians were suffering an equal amount back in London?
No. And I mean, it's also worth noting, you know, it wasn't just the men that were suffering, animals, you know, you had the animals were suffering, the infrastructure was suffering, you know, damage was being caused, the whole thing. I mean, frankly, had the politicians pulled their finger out, you might have actually have been able to evacuate before that storm. But hey-ho, we didn't. But
absolutely. I think it's terrible. And still, that they've got 91,000 men, you know, 200 guns, 5,000 horses and mules stuck ashore at Suvla and Anzac at the end of November. Remember our dates? Remember how quickly Monroe... I mean, and still, they'd had the meeting on the 24th. We can't decide. Let's have another meeting. They don't decide until the 7th, 8th of December, as far as, you know. So it's going on, it's going on. You know, and the port, we keep saying port. I keep saying port. A lot of the piers have been smashed up. You know, it's awful. Anyway, the preparations carry on. In accordance, they're in the preliminary stage, and some of the men began to notice what was going on. You know, they just see. Well, hang on, what's going on? Why aren't we bringing new stuff ashore? Why are the stores being hollowed out? You know, and this is Lance Corporal Edgar Rule. He's 14th Victoria Regiment. And he says, one of them put it to me like this. I came here with the first and I'll be here with the last. He was from Yorkshire, part of...
Clearly.
Yeah. We're sneaking off like whipped curs, remarked Sergeant Gaining. That's a fake name. I'll put his proper name in the book. Those who had mates in the cemeteries on the beach were fearful lest they would be violated, and the thoughts of leaving them weighed heavily. One man said to me, why can't we have another bee? Dash, 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 dash. Go at them. Now, whenever they do this, I always, my mind, my modern 20th century mind, puts in, does he mean bastard, bugger, or bloody? I mean, it's so...
I think you could use any of them.
Yes, you could. So, Brudenell White is still planning away. And you've got to give credit to him. But also, of course, Godley gets the plans and accepts them. He could have just said no. And everything's being done. They would evacuate stuff at night. And then vessels would be caught you know, seemingly caught offshore landing things. And they'd land men and stores, but then they'd go off again in that. It's all ruses. Men would be seen coming and going, but they're not, you know, the boxes of stores being unloaded would be empty. They'd leave the tents up when a unit was a thing. They even had men driving about in empty carts just to kick up the usual dust clouds, walking up and down tracks, kicking up dust. You know, just making people realise it would think it was the same. They flew more missions, partly to hold back the Turks, to stop their aircraft, seeing exactly what was going on. But also, the Turks began to think there was going to be another offensive. Because there's always these two things. Are they evacuated, or are they planning another offensive? And this is always going on. But the big guns start to come through from Bulgaria, through the lines, the new open line way from Germany and Austria. And they get quite a few Austrian mortars, big Austrian. And at Anzac, they start to get the first serious shelling by big guns with shells that explode with devastating effect. And this is Private George Scott, 4th New South Wales Battalion. He says, "We were resting in Victoria Gully, till then untouched by Turkish shellfire, when I was called away to watch a two-up game, and maybe hoping to try my luck as well." Two-up's a gambling game, which I've never understood, but Australians love it. Suddenly, a newly arrived howitzer battery dropped one among the five or six I'd just left. All died. Among them, I found Sergeant Jack Herbert, just alive. Before he died, he whispered, "They've got me downstairs, Scotty. No more fun for me." And I don't know why. I've always thought that it's just somehow, I don't know, really sad. "They've got me downstairs. No more fun for me." We all know what he was thinking about. And he died. And I have actually visited his grave. I think he's on number 4 Australian Parade Ground. I'm not quite sure about that now. Now, we brought up more naval guns, ships to sort of, because we were taking guns off, so our battery would be trimmed down for first to be 4, then to be 3 and 2, you know. But this is a quote. Who are you this time? This is a quote that I think, you know, explains for, and it also shows if you fire, the Turks will return fire. So tell us this quote. Who are you?
Corporal Frank Phillips, Southwestern Brigade Field Ambulance, RAMC. Watched 3 big battleships in the bay in front of us bombarding the Turks. Their noise was deafening. We could see some of our shells pitching on yonder hills. The Turks must have had a very warm time, but they were returning fire. I had my mess tin and had gone down to cookhouse to draw tea when some shells came over very close to us. A man was stretched out by his dugout with his head blown practically off, only the fleshy part of his face remaining, and his lifeblood was quickly flowing away. I could see all was up and had to get under cover quick as another shell came over, scattering dirt and bullets on the roof I was under. The dead man's dugout, whose name was Corporal Batstone, a very decent fellow who I knew well. I collected up pieces of his head and brains, some scattered about 15 yards from where he fell. Then I had my tea.
That just brings you to a bit of a stop, doesn't it? Literally with me there.
That's quite extraordinary.
It's the juxtaposition, isn't it?
And then I had my tea.
But of course, that's what life at Gallipoli was like. You know, you had to live, carry on. Now, Birdwood gets news 9:30. On 9:30 in the morning, on the 8th of December, that the government had finally made its mind. Yeah, well done. It's now, of course, winter. You know, winter's not coming, it's come. But this started in October, but now it's bloody December. And the intermediate thing starts. They've got to get off 77,000 men by this stage, 188 guns. They'd sent off the units that had been almost destroyed by the great storm. They were going to reduce it to 40,000 men, 20,000 at Suvla and 20,000 at Anzac. That would be an intermediate stage, 10 days, and then there'd be a two-day final stage, and that was going to be the 18th and 19th of December.
Why two days?
Because the Royal Navy could only deal with 20,000 men in one night.
Okay.
So, that's what it has to be. Now, I want to pay tribute to the engineers and the working parties there, because you know what the infantry have to do. They have to do the digging for the engineers a lot of time. They're road building. They're putting in roads where necessary. They're crossing the sandy areas. They're building light tramways. They're really working on the piers. They're trying to bolster them, hammering in pier. Piers is the word for. They're hammering in things and see you're helping. Hammering in sticky things, which are then the hold back and then filling them up with stones, wooden cribs they used. They're laying mines in no man's land. They're wiring up with trip wires. They've got barbed wire everywhere. There are 3,000 mines laid in the wide no man's land at Suvla. They're preparing the supply dumps for destruction. They'd be set with explosives and to be lit when they've gone. They're working on the last ditch defences. Now at Suvla they sort of stretch down in line and just goes round Lala Baba, covers off the two main where they're going to leave. But to be absolutely honest, when you read the last ditch line at Anzac, it almost is the Anzac line anyway. It's just it goes around pluggies, walkers, pluggies, and down McLagan's to the beach. And pluggies is going to be the keep. By now, some people have guessed, like we had the bloke before, who was guessing what was happening. But people aren't sure. And this is Brigadier General. You're going to be, I'll introduce you if you don't mind. Brigadier General John Monash, who's 4th Brigade. And he says this.
Being bound to secrecy, I can take none of my staff or COs into my confidence. I am almost frightened to contemplate the howl of rage and disappointment there will be when the men find out what is afoot.
Afoot? It's about 12 inches, Gary.
Thanks, mate.
Oh, sorry.
The old ones are the best, Peter.
Yeah, they are. They are the best. One sign that things are changing, and it, as we move, 10th, 9th, we're going through 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th of December, is that there starts to be more food about, because actually they're just using it up. Uniform, you can get yourself a nice new uniform. Do quartermaster sergeants normally give out uniforms at the drop of a hat?
They are noted for their generosity.
Generosity of spirit, the kindly nature. I know one quartermaster called Chris Carling, Major Chris Carling, but he has the spirit of a regimental sergeant major. I think no one would argue with that. He was in your brigade, wasn't he, when at TFL? He liked to call it a brigade because he had 4 colonels working for him, although he himself was at most a lance corporal. As he had 4 colonels working for him at TFL, he chose to describe himself as Brigadier Bane for quite some time, didn't you, Gary?
Yeah, the whole of the meal.
Anyway, 14th of December, they're finally briefed. And now they really start. And the men spend a lot of time, and I've put some of this in the book, setting up booby traps. So you open the door of a dugout, it sets off a Mills bomb. You tread on something, it sets off a Mills bomb. Tripwires, bombs. You've got the usual thing, Gary. Ooh, that's an interesting looking something. You touch it, bang.
I got a question about this because they were very busy setting up these booby traps. And I think,
they were.
I don't know if this is true or not, but I think there's a suggestion that Godley wrote a letter to his opposite number, referred to him as Excellency, where he was asking them to look after their dead and, be respectful. And yet we're running around setting up all these booby traps.
Yeah, I should be grateful if Your Excellency will take measures for their special preservation, the graves in the territory under your command. They've fallen far from home, fighting gallantly in our country's cause, and deserve that. Blah, blah, blah. And yeah, he did. And we're not sure whether he left that message. There's different sources saying different things. But what I would like to do is say, will the Turks respect the graves? Let's leave that, and let's come back to it in the sense at the end. And see whether they do respect the graves, because that is, and Godley leaves that on the, I think it's the 17th, 18th, when he leaves, he's meant to have left it. He certainly wrote it. Whether he left it is a completely, it doesn't matter whether he left it or not, really, in a sense, it's what's going through his mind. A lot of them, you've noticed before, I'm sure, people mention the graves. As they're going past them, they say, we're leaving you behind. And there is this underlying fear that something terrible will happen. Firstly, the desertion, although they're dead, but still desertion.
You're leaving your mates.
You're leaving your mates. Are their graves going to be respected? It's an underlying fear. They also, it's at this stage, 17th, that they start ramping up the cunning ploys. You know, it's the old Blackfellow. I have a cunning plan. And there's Charles Bean,
who's
the Blackadder. What did I say? Yeah, Blackadder. Yeah, I've no idea what I said now. Charles Bean took a last walk on the 17th round Anzac, which didn't take long. And you know what he saw has become a legend. Well, the first thing I love is he says this: a party of men were detailed to smoke and lounge about on Artillery Road corner where Gabatepe could see it. Well, I love that. Well, can you imagine soldiers being told?
I'll volunteer for that.
and to carry, you wouldn't volunteer for this one, and to carry water like staged soldiers round the road, through a sap, and then back again. So, like, so, you know, when soldiers march on the stage, go around, then march around the back and come out the other side. A little further on, I found the light horse playing cricket on Shell Green, Major Onslow batting, while the shells are flying far overhead. And that is the origin of the famous photograph, which even you, Gary, who don't like cricket, you seem to prefer football, although your choice of football team is eccentric, because the word football and Arsenal are not often closely connected, are they? Be honest. Is that a sulky silence I hear?
No.
Or have you accidentally switched your mute button on?
As a Liverpool fan, enjoy your asterisk.
Anyway, that's good. They're playing cricket and a couple of shells come across, but there's a very famous picture of that, and I believe the Australian cricket team came out and sort of redid it. There's a cemetery there, but there's a piece of grass in front of it where it took place.
And hopefully Matt could put that picture up, people can see that.
We will put it up, either him or me, or you. Since the end of November, something like 50,000 men had been evacuated, and the Turks still don't seem to know what's going on. But now we're coming to the last 2 days, the final stage. And that, like, it's like the denouement. It's like you watch Inspector Sausage investigates. You know, there's been 87 serial killing murders, and then you're going to find out who it is in the final 5 minutes as he explains to the seven people in front of him which one of them did it, you know, who done it. And which are, the question is, though, we know the result, but can you imagine if you're in those last 20,000 at Hellas, Suvla, last 20,000 at Anzac, you don't know whether you're going to live or die. Remember, there were predictions that up to 40, 50, 60% could be killed. Not killed, killed or captured or wounded, you know. This is a very tense part. Now, at this point, the staff work really ramps up and every single man is allotted a place. And to simplify it, they're divided into three parties. Party A, I love that, the army mind, would depart on the first night. So that's the night of the 17th. B, they'd leave at 9:30 at night, you know, so that's when it's dark, fully dark, and they'd creep off then.
So you mean 2130?
Yes, I do mean 2130. You just got that in just in time. And C parties, they'd move off between 2 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the morning, he said deliberately. Or would you prefer it's 0200 and 0300, Gary? Because I noticed I've written an 1500.
You've written 1500, yeah. I wasn't going to mention that.
Well, I've mentioned it because it made me laugh. So there were three C parties. They move off in stages, you know. So they're probably known as C1, C2 and C3, I would imagine, Gary.
And the C parties, I would imagine, are thinking that is the, you know, the worst of the three parties to be in. That is the most vulnerable of the three parties.
Oh, definitely. And they call for volunteers, and they always say every single man volunteered. You know, you always take that with a pinch of salt, but I believe, because the British historian saw it as well, so, you know. The morning of 18th of December dawns, you know, and the men, they spend the day destroying the stores, you know, minutes seem like hours, you know, it's just going on and on and on. And that night, the night of the 18th, the A parties leave. And there's no problem at all, Gary. So that leaves just 10,000 at Suvla and 10,000 at Anzac. Could they do it? And it's so exciting. Could they do it? So much could go wrong. If the Turks open fire, what I want to say, if they open fire and smash the piers, they couldn't get them off. Or even if they just disrupted the schedule. There's only so many hours of nightfall, and then they're going to be there, say 3,000 left, 5,000 left, trapped, the piers broken, and they attack and kill or capture them all. You know, it's really tense.
But even now, if you're looking at, you know, a measure of success, even were they to not get the final 10,000 off, they would still have seen the evacuation as successful at that point.
Probably at that point, yeah, because whatever happened, they'd get half of them off in the last stage, I would imagine, you know. Now, the last day, it's not a day of rest. It's Sunday, the 19th of December. It's not a day of rest. So much to do it. They're smashing boxes of rations. They're prodding tin cans. I don't see the point of that myself. There's millions of the buggers. They're doing all sorts of things. The final mules who move the last guns are being shot by. Thank you for your service.
Yeah, and not an easy task. Really,
no,
not an easy task.
No. Most of them get off. It's at Hellas that they couldn't get them off. They're checking the mines, the booby traps. They're doing all this. And here we have the famous self-shooting rifle, automatic rifle, if you're not automatic, but you know. Tell us about this. This was invented by, and you will be him, Lance Corporal William Scurry of the 7th Victoria Battalion. And this thing dominates all accounts now of the evacuation. But in actual fact, I'm not sure, sir. You tell the story.
He describes it well. I think just to be fair up front, most people would think that you squeeze a trigger, and generally when you're firing, you do. But in order to make these fire, you needed a jerk. And he describes exactly how that works. It occurred to me that if we could leave our rifles firing, we might get away more surely. The sand of the hourglass was the first germ of the idea. If the sand could be made to trickle from above into a container attached to the trigger, the increased weight would finally release it. Next day, I started on the idea, but it wouldn't work. The sand wouldn't run, and the trigger wanted a jerk to pull it. The jerk was easily got over by the cartridge box full of dirt, but water was the only thing that I could think of to replace the sand. So the cartridge box would fall, that would create the jerk, and the gun would fire.
But the point about this is what you get nothing. Self-firing rifles, it dominates the popular myth. And when Matt puts it up, I bet he has a picture of a self-firing rifle. In fact, when he put the advert up for it, he did. The 7th Victoria Battalion mentions only six of them were left, and they only delayed the firing by 30 minutes. But that 30 minutes is vital at Anzac. It's a difference of time between being on the, you know, the second ridge and being back in the, you know, you could get back to the sea in that time. Now, it's a terrible day. They're on tenterhooks. And during that day, the Turk guns would open up. And everyone would think, oh, my God, and then the guns would stop. An aeroplane would fly across. They'd go, oh, my God, you know. The Turks would do something, fire a mortar or something. It's all going on. And that day, when you talk about it's a very short day. It's probably one of the shortest of the year, although I'm not good at when that date is. But it must have seemed like the longest day, to use another famous phrase, for the people who just waiting for nightfall. You know, can you imagine it, Gary?
Yeah, it must have been terrible. And I've not seen that film either, The Longest Day.
It's too long. Now, Birdwood, during the day, Birdwood pays his final visit to Anzac. And I love this quote. I found it. I'd seen it before, but not noticed the humour of it. So I think it's like a really cheap metaphor for the whole Gallipoli expedition. And when I say it's a cheap metaphor, it's the sort of thing that a serious historian, an academic of some sort, they wouldn't use it because they would think it was scurrilous. But I love it because it just sums up for me Gallipoli. Carry on, Gary. Who are you?
I'm General Birdwood. So there was a curious little incident as I landed at Anzac that day for the last time. Matting had been laid on the landing stage to ensure silence when the men embarked. And as I stepped ashore, I caught my foot in this and fell flat on the beach. At that particular moment, the landing stage was under rifle fire from the enemy. And not unnaturally, everyone thought for a moment that I had been hit. What bad luck that would have been on our very last day.
And I just love it because it's the idea of falling flat on your face and landing at Anzac. It's pretty well what, I'm not decrying the heroism of those Anzac troops, but that's fundamentally what happened. They fell flat on their faces and ended up with the world's smallest beachhead, able to do nothing. And that rather sums it up. Now, I'm not going to... The evacuation of Suvla, there's only so much time for a podcast. Evacuation of Suvla goes without a problem. They get back the 3 miles, they leave behind, but surely they couldn't do it at Anzac. The trenches are only, you know, all along Second Ridge. So it's the, you know, by the side of the road that runs along it now, Gary, that we've walked along so many times, driven along. It's just the
Quinn's,
top of that
Lone, Lone Pine. I mean, they're literally measured in yards.
Yeah, and Quinn's, of course, it's measured in feet. Could they do it? Could they do it? If they get caught, then they're going to get they're going to get shelled out. They get the piers will be destroyed and they'll be trapped. Now they dug several mines, 3 mines especially that they used. They dug more, but they used the three under Russell's Top, which is where the neck is. You know you've got that in your mind. And this was to disrupt any Turkish attack. The day passes much as at Suvla, and at 2100 hours, so half an hour early, the B parties start to go back. Now, it's pitch dark. Now, they've laid down flour and salt and things to form a way, but it must have been murder. No lights trying to get down, you know. And from 2100 hours, basically, there's only the three C parties, C1, 2 and 3. And if their Turks attack then, they're not going to get back. They're not. And up on Lone Pine, the 2nd Lieutenant George McElroy and his C3 party, 24th Victoria Battalion. And he says this, "Our orders were clear. The position must be held, even though attacked heavily, until 3 a.m. at all costs. The phone from the rear was cut off, leaving three officers and 34 other ranks doing their best to sound like a whole battalion, though feeling somewhat isolated in the world. For as far as we could tell, no other Australian troops were on either flank for some distance. When each officer, precisely at 2:40 a.m, moved along his front with instructions to slip quietly out to the rendezvous in Gun Lane, instead of the frenzied anxiety to depart which one might have expected, the popular idea of the moment seemed to be just another shot at the old asterisk. What is it, bastard? I'm going to first. Just another shot at the old bastard before we go. That's the spirit of the Aussies. The 24th Battalion leave Lone Pine at 02:40. Quinn's and Pope's are held till 5 to 3. Russell's Top till 3:15. Walker's Ridge finally abandoned about 3:25. The men have got blankets wrapped around their boots. They're following these trails and they're going back. And this is when the two things, you've got the self-firing rifles going bang every so often. Not many, but just a smattering of shots, yeah? But the other thing is, effectively, you've got a silent period. And there are you. There are you in your trench. Now, you're a Turkish... Let's make you a lance corporal. What would you do? It's all gone quiet again. Do you report that?
No.
To your officer?
No.
Say I'm the officer. Do you report it to me?
No.
Because what will I do?
You'll make if me you go report out. It
to... And what happened to your mate, Balint? Balint, your mate, what happened to him when he went out?
He got gravely injured and went completely mad.
Ramazan, what happened to Ramazan, your other mate?
He would.
Anyway, so they're all creeping out. So the curiosity killed the cat. Could be what they've been. It's psychology. They've been taught not to investigate silent periods.
In modern in parlance, they've been conditioned, haven't they? They are now conditioned to behave in a particular way.
Isn't it brilliant, Gary? I just think it's brilliant. Because what the normal way, if you're evacuated, would be to launch a huge diversion, but not here. Here, it's a new thing. It's brilliant. Now, the last party are the engineers upon Russell Top, Lieutenant James Caddy and a bunch of sappers are from 5th Field Company, Australian Engineers. Now, tell us what you're going to do this. Can you read this one for us?
Sergeant Conton pushed down the exploder connected with the mines in L8 and L11, and immediately afterwards...
Hang on, they're the two mines stretching onto under the neck, yeah?
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's fine. And immediately afterwards, I fired the big mine in Arnold's Tunnel. The ground vibrated. There was a dull roar and two large craters were formed. Immediately afterwards, heavy rifle fire opened up along the whole of the enemy line. After slabs of gun cotton to destroy the exploders had been set off and Corporal Penny had lit the fuse of the mine on the track leading down to the beach, we made as quickly as possible down the hill.
Now, that explosion, especially... No, I didn't fit it because I disrupted you first time. Arnold's Tunnel, we've seen the crater last time we were there. You know the people who've been responsible for clearing the battlefield showed us that crater at the back where the buses turn round at the neck.
Yeah.
That crater is still there. It killed 70 Turks, and the Turks burst into life, but it's too late. And when they get back down to the beach, Sergeant, 2nd Lieutenant George McElroy, he's 24th Victoria still, he says, we crowded onto the barge lying alongside the jetty and between decks was soon filled with a mass of unshaven, haggard and dirty-looking diggers, all talking at once, and the air was thick with tobacco smoke. After the recent strain of the prohibition on smoking for fear of the lighting of matches might arouse suspicion, one can imagine the clamour which broke out, everyone at once trying to tell the other fellow his experiences. They all get away. I think two are lightly wounded. And so all along the coast of Anzac and Suvla, they've got away. And the stores and dumps are set fire to. The warships roll in and start to bombard, to destroy as much. In total, they got off 83,048 men, 186 guns and 2,000 vehicles and 4,695 horses and mules. They had no casualties at Suvla and just two men wounded at Anzac. It is unbelievable. It was all too late for the Turks. By the time they knew what was happening, they went forward. Still, there are some killed. But they flood across no man's land eventually, taking casualties. And Colonel Hans Kanengas, there's another quote from him. Tell us what he says.
He says, the hungry Turks swarmed out of their narrow trenches and flowed like locusts across the English trenches, depots and stores. As was their custom, they received everything quietly, calmly, without any expression of joy. Still, they were not now to be held, either by the orders of their officers, or by exploding mines, or by the broadsides from English warships, which fired wherever they saw troops congregate. Cakes, jam, corned beef, biscuits, these were unthought-of delicacies, and here they were lying freely all around. In addition, woolen and rubber covers, coats, boots, putties, etc. What more could they wish for? I allowed them free liberty that day. They had richly earned it.
Now, the British had done really well, British Australians, everybody had done well to escape. But one thing I'd make is, and we'll come back to this in the second episode, the Turks had won. They had earned their keep. But let's make the final point. Did they respect the graves? Because so many of the men refer to seeing the graves as they went. And now, what, do you think they respected the graves?
Well, I don't think anybody did immediately after the battles of the Great War, and indeed after the conflict. But you and I have both been there, and they certainly do now. I know, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission do fantastic work there, but they're local people, they're very well tended, and actually, I don't know if this is the right way to describe them, but Beach Cemetery, for example, is beautiful. It's incredibly well maintained, and they show an enormous amount of respect.
They do, and they have. And this, despite the provocation, there was no the graves weren't in there. Some of the graves, the markers were burnt. That's because they were wood, and there were crosses, which is not their religion. But the graves were respected. Despite the fact that there were a large number of booby traps left, which are not the most gentlemanly method of warfare. So in some ways, Godley had a cheek. Leave booby traps everywhere. And, but can you respect our graves? Don't worry about the men we've just killed. And, the 70 dead at Russell's Top. There are two ways of looking at things generally. Well, I've enjoyed talking to you about this. I hope you'll all be intrigued and want to buy the book, which is coming out on Living History, The Evacuation of Gallipoli. This is the first part of two podcasts, but it's been great to talk about it, talk it through with you, Gary, because as ever, you've added your insights and just made it, just more obvious to me what this is all really about. And I'd like to thank you and say goodbye.
Well, before you go, I think it's worth also adding that if people could get out to the battlefield and visit, it is well worthwhile. You mentioned, you know, Arnold's tunnel and the crater is now visible. There's a great amount of work making the battlefields more accessible. If you can get out there, please do. You will not be disappointed. It is a fantastic country, and you are made to feel incredibly welcome. And you can get out there and see things on the battlefield that we are talking about.
That's a great point. I can't wait to get back there with you and with Matt, actually. Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?